I'm Paul Wiegraf, Director of the Delaware Division of the Arts, and your host for today. Joining me remotely is Arianne Harley Emerson, the Director of Music and Operations for the Choir School of Delaware, as well as the President of the Board of the Delaware Arts Alliance. Welcome, Arianne.
Thank you so much for having me. How are you?
Great. So glad to have you joining me today. I reached out to you because I know you've been doing a tremendous amount of research on choral singing in a COVID world and post-COVID world, but you've also had some major kudos coming your way at the choir school. So I want to touch on both of those. Let's start with the research you've been doing on choral singing, because it has implications not only for so many choral groups here in Delaware, but also for the more general performing arts world in theater and storytelling and so on. Talk a little bit about the research you've been doing.
So through the American Choral Directors Association, I have been, you know, that association is contributing to several studies that are currently in progress. And we, as an association, have just released some guidance for scenario planning for choral ensembles. And what has been wonderful is to have these resources, particularly in this one document, which I will, I'll send you links to in case anyone is looking for follow-up a follow-up link to know what we're referring to here. But there is a comprehensive document by two organizations. One is ACDA, talking about the future of choral singing and scenario planning for the fall. And the other is through NAFME, the National Association for Music Education, which also this week released their own guidance document for governing music instruction in the classroom for this fall, including choral ensemble singing. But to get to where to the meat of this research that is being done, that is being scientifically done, and recommendations and guidelines that are coming to choral directors for their ensembles, the story is that so much is still unknown. And until we have a vaccine, that we should all be using our best judgment, and we should be judicious and discerning when we are in groups, if we are in groups. So at this current moment, the research indicates that we are not yet ready, even this fall, to be making music together in person. Certainly not the way that it looked prior to COVID-19. Masked singing is still not recommended because we are still super spreaders, because there's so much more airflow that's going on. There's a lot of debate about exactly how far droplets are spread when one sings. There are conflicting data points coming in. Some are saying, you know, 14 feet is what you need to remain safe. And then there have been others that say that 6 to 8 feet is actually sufficient. So there's still a lot that we do not know. And given that there is no conclusive evidence, we should err on the side of caution. So at this moment, the recommendation is, what can you do without singing to prepare for choir? And that could be what you're doing together and socially distant with non-music, with not singing. That's like using ORF instruments, that's doing diction, doing rhythm, doing other sorts of things that are not using vocal production. So that's one way that we are kind of looking at this and recommending. And of course, to be in the virtual format where we're utilizing tools like Zoom for rehearsals. Yes, all the singers have to be on mute. It's an interesting experience because the ensemble, you're learning and experiencing and reacting based on what's happening around you. So that is not possible to happen on Zoom yet. However, there are innovations that we can do. For instance, you can sing all of the parts, record them in some sort of program, and use that as an aid so that when you are using a rehearsal on Zoom or Google Meets, you are simulating. It's not going to be perfect. It's not going to be like it's in real time. It's not going to be like a real rehearsal, but you can simulate that experience for the singer, even though they're singing from behind their own screen and in their own home. So that's the big part of kind of what we're talking about. There are some technologies that are being cultivated. There is a great resource called My Choral Coach, which has a bunch of tools in it for choirs to be able to use to move to virtual rehearsals, part tapes. You can upload samples of singing to recreate this choral feeling from home. You can access free scores that are already uploaded that you can use. So there's a lot that's there. There are some groups that have done extreme social distancing in singing, meaning parking lot rehearsals. So that is an option for people. Again, there are the same complications that you would have, meaning you can't stay together. Like, how do you hand out music? There are a lot of considerations. And then if you're in a parking lot, do you have access to Wi-Fi so that you can have access to PDF? So it becomes a little bit more complicated, but it can be done. You absolutely can have parking lot rehearsals, but the science is pretty definitive. It's inconclusive. So our actions should certainly be in not doing close quarters indoor singing. Like, it's pretty clear that we're not yet ready for that. There is no timeline. I've heard 18 to 24 months. I personally hope that that is not the case. Some people say it's until we have herd immunity because a vaccine is not going to come. So there's just a lot that's unknown. But for those folks who are looking to plan for the fall, my personal recommendation is that you move forward with your season. That might mean your programming looks a little bit different. It might mean that your repertoire is a little bit more accessible or easier. I always hate to use such a term as easier because it can be less complex in its nature, but we can up our game on our artistic expression during this period of time. But we can program differently so that we can successfully launch virtual choirs and virtual programs, and so that we can explore kind of some extremely distant, small ensemble singing. So that's really where we are with it. Most people who are looking like, well, can't I have high ceilings and UV lights and all of that? You can if you have millions of dollars to do that to your rehearsal room for a one-time only thing. I personally don't think it's worth the resources. And if you do have the resources to do that to your own rehearsal room, we need to talk because you know something that I don't.
Well, I seem to recall seeing some research being done, or not research, but proposals about rehearsal spaces. You know, I would imagine it would have to be the size of a football field, but indoor rehearsal spaces and some of the considerations to maintain not only the physical distancing, but also such issues as airflow and,
yes,
and you know, replacement and ventilation and all that kind of stuff, and the duration of rehearsals that,
yes,
that I mean, a two-hour rehearsal in a choir room is what got a lot of churches in trouble early, yes, on. So did you come across anything like that as they're trying?
Yeah, so people are definitely looking at, like, how does air flow? How far does it flow? What kind of HVAC systems in a room, how does that impact, you know, the spread of droplets, COVID-19 droplets? And again, every single study that comes out that looks hopeful, there's another study that comes out that dashes those hopes. Mm-hmm. So we just don't know at this point. So if you don't know, it's better to err on the side of caution, in my humble opinion, than to have some of these incidents like with the choirs that you've been hearing where there have been super spreaders and people contracting. But long story short, what we can say is when we are ready to go back to singing in a socially distant form, which could, who knows, maybe it will be later in the fall, but that would look like plenty of space for singers. It would look like it would be masked at this point and needing to have a space that has high ceilings and good ventilation. So that means we're looking at mostly spaces that we don't have. We're looking at churches. We're looking at some large halls, spaces like that, that we might not have available to us. And many of those spaces, which are great, but might be older and don't have the proper HVAC systems that are circulating enough air per hour and per minute to make it safe for singers.
Yeah, it's interesting that you've been doing so much research on this, because I think a lot of performing arts organizations and venues, and understandably so, are thinking about audiences and how do you bring audiences back in a responsible way to ensure mm-hmm. physical distancing of audiences. But your focus really has been very heavily on the performance side.
Yes. Yes. So, and I think that's going to be something that we're all going to have to look at, is it's like, great, even if we can make it safe for our patrons, can we make it safe for our performers?
Okay. Well, I want to switch gears here and talk about how this has impacted what you've been doing with the Choir School of Delaware. But first, let me remind our listeners that you're tuned into Delaware State of the Arts here on News Radio 1450 WILM and 1410 WDOV. Joining me remotely is Ariane Harley Emerson, the Director of Music and Operations for the Choir School of Delaware, and not incidentally, the President of the Board of the Delaware Arts Alliance as well, who has been doing just an amazing job at keeping at the forefront the importance of public funding as well as private funding to support arts organizations at a time that is extremely difficult, because, I mean, since mid-March, organizations' earned revenue has basically been turned off. So, Ariane, I appreciate the work you and Jessica Ball have been doing with the Delaware Arts Alliance to keep that at the forefront of public funders' consciences, as well as the private sector in supporting the arts. Now, the whole the research you've done, how have you applied this to your operations at the choir school? Because you've been adamant about not losing contact with your clientele.
Yes. So I think that's been the big thing. And even before the research came out, there were some things that we decided as an organization that we were going to commit to. And I like to call them the three C's: community, connectedness, and consistency. And so we wanted to ensure that there was a sense of community that was still there, that our students and adults were seeing each other, that it felt like they were able to express themselves still and to be able to reap the benefits of a community. Connectedness, we wanted to make sure that 100% of our students were connected to be able to engage on a virtual platform. So very early on, we secured technology and donations through a number of generous donors that helped us to do that. We made sure that every single child and family had an internet connection in our program. And we just did the hard work to do that so that we could stay connected to one another, so that we could provide not just musical education and rehearsals and things like that, but so we could provide a lot of social services and supports, which there was an increased demand on because there's an equity issue here when we look at the impacts of COVID. And so a lot of those families didn't have that technology, or had parents that were essential workers. And it's really interesting that when we look at who's essential, oftentimes it is folks from our low-income Black and brown communities, which mm-hmm. meant that those families were not actually able to be there during the day to make sure school was happening and all that. So we were able to step in and help keep that connectedness. And then consistency, we felt we needed to do this every single day, just like you were going to go to school every day, you were going to meet with us every day, we were going to check in on your homework every day, we were going to have rehearsals at our appointed times. And so that was also important and is really critical to the social emotional health of not just our students, but also for our adults too, many of whom are in isolation and aren't venturing out very much. So that was really what we believed. And week one, we were pivoted by mid-March completely to a virtual format. So we worked really hard to make that happen.
So how much of your reaching out to your students has been one-on-one, and how much of it has been group work?
Oh, a lot of the early days were one-on-ones. It was like, okay, what do we need to do? Okay, what do you have at home? Is it a tablet? Is it a computer? What do you need? Toilet paper? What do you need? Like, there were a lot of like social service, hand sanitizer, wipes. It was a lot of things that were needed, like tangible kind of items. So that was definitely on a one-on-one basis. But once we had everyone kind of taken care of with some of those kind of basic needs, then it was more group-based. However, we still did wellness checks with everyone, all of our adults, all of our volunteers, all of our students, all of our families. And so we do that on a daily basis, just a wellness check, just to make sure that everyone has what they need, make sure the technology is working, make sure that you're in school where you're supposed to be in school, all those sorts of things. We made just a part of our daily routine.
Now, you alluded to this earlier about, I think, making recordings. Yes. What kind of work did you have to do to sort of be able to work with your students in these group settings?
Yes. So that was definitely a challenge. And I certainly could not do this all by myself. It was definitely a team effort with all of us on staff at the choir school. But we essentially made accompaniment recordings. So we recorded all the piano accompaniments. We would record part tapes of just the piano playing parts. We would do it with us singing all of the parts as well, so that we could people could practice with other voices, which is very helpful for our singers as well. So we did hours, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of recording, as did our students. So we worked to have a concert, and we had our gala concert that moved forward and was very successful. But we essentially had everyone record themselves, audio and video, and we edited it all together, and we had a full-length, fundraising concert. So it can be done. I think that you can be frustrated by the process and intimidated by the process, and the amount of time that you do hand-wringing and walking in circles. If you just kind of get to the meat of the work, you'll get it done, and it gets faster the more you do it.
So in addition to teaching music, have you been able to continue teaching the art of singing? Because the two things are different.
So I've been doing voice lessons via Zoom. So it is a different, it feels very different. So, I sit at the piano, which is just behind me, and I'm able to play the accompaniment and the students can sing, and then I can say, stop, okay, we're going to break down this one thing that I heard, and then I need to demonstrate and do it first, and then they have to do it because of the latency issue with Zoom. But then we kind of do this exchange of back and forth until we get what we actually need to do. So yes, you can pretty effectively teach voice lessons via Zoom, and I actually think that I feel like a better educator, because you begin to be more clear in your language and your direction to your students. Like, here is the specific thing that I want you to do, because, we often get into the art part of it and we forget that singing is like a physical science. It's mm-hmm. like, what you need to do? You need to relax the larynx, which you can do X and Y and Z to try to relax the larynx, which will produce this sound. And, you think, oh my God, a 10-year-old can't understand that, but they can. And they did. So yeah, it's a great way to move forward.
Now, I'm curious, you have relied heavily and very well on the use of volunteers. Have you been able to keep them engaged during
Yes. that? We lost some, we gained some, right? So you're kind of like, you're exactly where you were. Our volunteers, like volunteers for most nonprofits, tend to be an older demographic, I would say 60 plus. So that meant that there were some who were intimidated by the technology. And so that was a barrier for them. Not that they didn't have it, but it was intimidating. But then there were also a bunch of other people who were like, I've never had the time to be able to volunteer before. I would love to do it. And many folks who just were like, I'm going to give this a try because I really miss just connecting with people. Volunteers came on every day. They read to students. They tutored students. They did homework with students. They mentored students. They did science projects. So yeah, we could not have done all that we did this, since March semester, mm-hmm. quarter mm-hmm. and a half mm-hmm. without that support.
Well, we've got just a couple minutes left, so I want to give you an opportunity to toot your own horn. You've been recognized recently for the great work you've been doing through all of this. You want to speak to that?
Yeah, so we're really excited. Last week, it was announced that the choir school was a recipient of the Lewis Prize for Music, which is a relatively new prize in the last couple of years, but there's a very rigorous process for it. And so we were awarded a $50,000 grant, which is like huge, like significant for us, just a game changer for what we can continue to provide this summer and through the fall. So we are really grateful for that. There were 626 applications and they chose 32, and we were fortunate enough to be amongst those. And they have excellence and equity are the thrust of what they do here for music programs for young adults. And so we were just completely thrilled and surprised, and it was very affirming of kind of the work that we are continuing to carry out. So we were so, so grateful for that news and for that support.
What was the basis of the application process? What were they looking for specifically? We've got about a minute left.
Sure. Specifically, they were looking to see how programs were pivoting to deliver virtual programming. So we sent a pretty extensive video sampling of what we had been doing, which included voice lessons, piano lessons, choral rehearsals, and also academic support and enrichment. So we kind of used Zoom, which you can just hit the record button, and we threaded it together. And there was a significant application that also had artistic quality of your program outside of COVID. So they wanted to make sure that, you do the real deal, even, outside of this context. So it was definitely a rigorous process, but it was very rewarding.
And before we sign off, how can our listeners find out more about the Choir School of Delaware?
Our listeners can find out more by visiting us on our website, which is just Choir School of Delaware, Delaware all the way spelled out, .org. Again, that's Choir School of Delaware.org. Or you can look us up on our social media accounts. Our Facebook is just facebook.com/choirschool, and at Choir School of Delaware on Instagram. So you can find us there or on YouTube. Just, Google Choir School of Delaware, or put in the search bar rather on YouTube, and you can see some of what we've been doing virtually. And you can also check out our summer and fall programming so that we've got lined up.
Great. Well, Arianne Harley Emerson, thanks so much for joining us today and for all you are doing to keep choral singing alive.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you for having me.